back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Wayne. Today on the show, legendary Canadian guitarist, Leona Boyd. Actually, she was born in London, but we're going to talk about that. I haven't talked to her yet. This is rare where I do the intro where I have not talked to her yet. But Liz, my now wife, thank you very much, just went and I don't know what she's doing, but she said she's going. And I absolutely hate doing intros in front of her. Even if she's in the other room, it's just the knowledge that someone can hear me say, welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Wayne. It's I don't know. All right. So I'm excited to have her on. She has a huge discography. She's been obviously an influence on all of us. And she's been releasing albums since, you know, the early 70s. So this is just, I mean, it's going to be great. I'm really looking forward to this. I've always known about her, you know. When I was a kid, the only classical guitar albums were the Naxos ones with a bunch of guitarists that you barely knew. And then there was like Leona Boyd, there was Sharon Isbin, there was Elliot Fisk, there was John Williams, there was Julian Bream, you know, a handful of others. You had to kind of know what was going on to get beyond that. David Russell, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and say he was even a little fringe back then. But so that's how old I am, 45. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So I'm real happy to have her on this show. I have to pick good ones now because I'm not able to do this as much. And it you know, it breaks my heart. I want to do it all the time. I want to interview everybody. But really, now that I'm playing again, now that I'm performing again too, there's a whole bunch that happened. I got married, I'm performing. I really got to kind of... it's not that I don't want to talk to everybody. You know, this is the thing. I get a lot of people asking me to come on the show that I don't know. And it's an honor that you would think of me to you know, at the beginning of your career as sort of an outlet. And I think that's great. I'm not always going to be able to do it. Sometimes I do it. And I know it doesn't seem fair. But I think I'm going to be able to do that less and less. It doesn't mean you shouldn't reach out. I love it. I love, you know, learning about your albums and being part of the younger guitar community. It's cool. You know, I'm a cool guy. But if I'm only doing this once every month or two, remember when I used to do it every other week? Anyway, this is all I ever talk about on this show, the intro. You know what I should be talking about is Savage Classical. I don't even know how to spell it anymore. It's been so long. Savage. S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. SavageClassical.com is where you can go to get the guitar of your dreams. Just tell them Big Diaper Brett sent you. Anyway, so we're going to move on with that. That is our only thing, I believe, today. I don't have any special... Nobody wanted to buy a spot. You can always buy a spot. You know, Florida Guitar Festival did it. Or whatever, you know, you can always just let me know about the projects and, you know, we'll give you a reasonable rate and we'll put you in the intro here. Anyway, so yes, I got married and that's huge. If you've been listening to the show for the last, whatever it is, 13 years, you know that I've had my ups and downs. And I don't mean bad. I mean, well, you know, some of the times were bad, but that's all over now. We got married at the courthouse in Manhattan. We went to Manhattan instead of Brooklyn. I'm a little disillusioned with the cool Brooklyn thing. I kind of don't like it here very much right now. I like it. I mean, it's nice. I'm kind of just over the whole all the attitude and the dumb outfits and stuff, you know. People dress, everybody's wearing those big, like moms from Nebraska would wear them. Like they maybe have some sort of design on them. They're made out of wool. There's a bunch of like men walking around in these long wool, you know, jackets. I hate those things. I hated them when they were new. I hate them now. Anyway, now I got to watch everybody wearing them. And, you know, watching my mind get changed, get morphed and warped by these idiots into thinking this stuff looks good. But I don't know. You know, I guess it's just the, you know, the thrift store thing, right? That's the culture. That's the idea, is that you don't wear anything new. I can respect that. You know, there's enough clothes out there, right? My problem is that these things in my little neighborhood here cost hundreds of dollars for something that looks like shit. And that gets me. Anyway, so we got married. I don't hate Brooklyn. I love Brooklyn. We got married in Manhattan at the courthouse in downtown Manhattan. And we went to, it was just my brother and my sister-in-law, Molly. And they were responsible. My poor brother had to take all the pictures. He did an incredible job. Because I don't like wedding photographers. Liz was talking about maybe getting a wedding photographer. I said, it's not that I don't want to pay for one. I just don't like them. You know how there's certain occupations you don't like? I think wedding photographers are one of mine. I'm like, what gives you the right to decide that you're a wedding? I don't know. It's and the pictures are never good. We were at the courthouse and someone was taking a picture of somebody from under them, which is just, as you know, just shows a lot of, you know, you get the double chins and everything. And I took Liz. Well, this is when we were getting the paper signed, because you get the paper signed before you go and you do the ceremony. You have to get the license before. A week has to pass, give you some time to think about, running. And then you come back. But when we were there for the license, there was a wedding photographer there. And I had already kind of, not had an argument, but I usually I give in to Liz because she's usually right about everything. But I said, you know what? I think I'm going to stick with this, because I know my brother took photography in high school. His pictures are pretty good on Instagram. I think that's going to be better than some schmo who, you know, can't get work and is a wedding photographer. I know that there's a lot of wedding photographers out there. I just think you guys, I respect that you're making a living at it. I just think you take terrible pictures. And if you look at anybody's wedding pictures, you know I'm right. They're cheesy. They're stupid. One of my friends had her picture taken and her husband was tickling her feet. Isn't that disgusting? It's shit like that that makes me just not want a wedding photographer. So anyway, we didn't have a wedding photographer. We had Rory and it was great. And then afterwards, my friends had a dozen, you know, my little Brooklyn friends said, oh, you got to go to this. You got to go to that. And we ignored them. We went to a dim sum place in Chinatown, which is you know, about a 10-minute walk up from the courthouse. And we had the time of our lives. And we got very full, and we four of us had to go home and take a nap. But before that, it was so much fun. Great. Honored. Happy to have my wedding. It wasn't the wedding I pictured when I was a little boy, you know, with all my classical music friends playing, I don't know, Strauss Morgan in the background. That was a song I wanted. One of my friends got married to Morgan. You know that song? You know, I forget how to do it. But anyways, I never knew how to do it in the first place. But that was always, I thought, oh yeah, I got all these classical. Well, you know, my classical friends have come and gone. And so it just became a courthouse wedding. We pissed off a couple of people who wanted to be there, namely, but we have, you know, two sets of parents that are alive. They were okay with it. But we also are doing something in April anyway. We're kind of doing a wedding anyway in April. But it's just with the immediate family. Anyway, I would suggest this to anybody who is thinking about it. Because one of the things, there's a lot of things that held me back from getting married. But one of the things that always sort of went, you know, when I was younger and maybe didn't have as much money, I was sitting there thinking, how am I going to afford these things? These things are $20,000. Just start. You're not getting out of these things with $20,000 anymore. Anyway, I'm the only one on my side who didn't have a wedding. Liz and her two brothers, God bless them. My new brothers, Sam the Sandwich Man and Doug, they both had courthouse weddings. My two brothers didn't. They had big blowouts. Anyway, that's the big deal. Second thing is that I performed for the first time in 5 years, really. I can't believe it, but that's the truth. It was the end of 2018, I think, when I performed. 2017, even? I don't remember, but it was with the quartet. As far as being a soloist, it's the first time in forever. Man, is it a lot of music to memorize, isn't it? And, you know, I memorize everything. Mostly my own stuff, some Scarlatti, and some Dale Cavanaugh I played. Very excited. I thought that was going to be the most challenging because of my dystonia, my A finger. But I got through it. I was able to be expressive. It was a little slower than it's generally performed. It was a three preludes and a damn fine piece and three pieces. The two Scarlattis and then, you know, mostly my stuff. And it was great. You know, the first one was just a smaller concert. So I just did my stuff. And then when I introduced all the other stuff and it was like, you know, an hour plus of music, it was... I was just excited to kind of get through it without any serious memory slips. The first one I had, so then I just devoted myself for about a week and a half to visualization. And it worked. It was great. Anyway, that's what's going on in my neck of the woods. It's a lot. There's a lot going on. And it's also, it's the holidays. Hanukkah and Christmas are lining up with each other this year, I believe. Around the same time, I remember it was either last year or the year before, all the kids, I work in a Jewish school and have for about 16 years, and the kids were bummed because it didn't line up well with the Christmas holiday. So they had all this time off, but am I right about this? I don't mean to, you know, make a mistake, but I think they were just kind of like, yeah, you know, we get this big break and there's, you know, there's no Hanukkah in it. So anyway, that's what I'm doing. I'm just doing we got the tree. I'm married. We're trying to have a kid. It's a whole, you know, it's big changes between this episode and the last one, because I don't do them very often. Anyway, I want to make sure I have some people on. I just wanted to, you know, try to kind of have some, I don't know. There's some sort of logic to who I have on and who I don't have on, but it's basically about just how much time I have, and right now I don't have that much time, so it's big guns, and boy have we got a big gun today. I got high hopes for this interview. We're gonna see how it goes, and this is my time with the immortal Leona Boyd. Maestro Boyd, you have a an illustrious career. Your first albums were out in the mid-70s, and you've gone on to play with, you know, cross-genre people like Al Di Meola, some of my favorites like Strunz and Farah, and some people that everybody knows like Eric Clapton and the like. So you've been everywhere.
And David Gilmour.
Yes. David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. I don't even know where to begin with you other than just at the beginning. It's just outstanding. Everybody you studied with and everybody you've worked with, it's really a unique career.
Yes,
in a lot of ways. It's a career that kind of comes from the, I guess you could call it the silver age of the classical guitar, but it's more or less, from a recording standpoint, it's almost like a golden age, you know, you and
it John really Paul. Was but yeah. Very few guitarists around, not like today.
No, and that's kind of what I said in the intro. I said that when I'm 45, and when I went to the record store, it was you, it was maybe some Sharon Isbin, and it was...
No, she wasn't even around at the beginning. It was around. Joan Williams, Julian Bream, Narciso Yepes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you could find an Elirio Diaz, but Sharon came a lot later, actually.
What about Narciso Yepes? You bring him up, and one of the interesting things that I read about him was that he claims to have... Maybe you can clarify this for me and for others, but it's claimed that he developed the annular, the ring finger technique, or at least used it when it was largely out of use. Is that true, or is there any weight to that statement?
I don't think so. I know he had a 10-string guitar. He kept wanting to persuade me to lug a 10-string around the world. No, I said 6 strings are quite enough for me to cope with, but he was very sweet. Came to visit me once in my little garret in Paris, huffing and puffing up 8 flights of stairs. You know, I had a chambre de bonne, a maid's room, basically, that's the size of, a quarter of the size of one of my closets and when I lived in Beverly Hills. But he was a very good teacher, and I was so sad when he passed on. He was humble, and he could hardly see. He used to use a micro, magnifying glass, or to read his scores. And he told me that he did a lot of his preparation for concerts just sitting on the plane, doing it all mentally, without the benefit of having a guitar in his hand. So I tried to do a little bit of that, but he was obviously, that was one of the secrets to his success.
Was the sort of necessity of mm-hmm. having to memorize it.
Yes.
And you, I mean, you've also studied with everybody. You've studied with Segovia and Bream.
Well, Segovia, I played for him several times, and he did give me advice, not formal studies. I've formally studied with, Eddie Kastner and with Julian Bream in the master class. But people, do you remember Alice Arts? She came to give master classes. She's a New Yorker, like you.
No, I wasn't around for that, but I also don't usually know.
She was a student of Presti and LaGoya. And I studied with LaGoya for 2 years. I was his private student, and a little more if you read my book. I got 2 years of wonderful lessons from the maestro, and he was like a fatherly figure and looked after me. And then his girlfriend and I became friends. If I get sick in Paris, I was a penniless student. I used to even punch the metro tickets because I had no money. I'd reuse them. But I would do 6-7 hours of guitar practice. Then I got lucky and lived in a chateau, all by myself, mind you, just with the old concierge and gardener. But I became obsessed with classical guitar, I guess, in high school, and I started winning little prizes. And then I did 4 years, a music degree at the University of Toronto. Now they have guitar orchestras. Jeffrey McFadden runs the department. But back then it was really just the domain was just little guitar societies scattered all over the world. And I played for dozens and dozens of them.
Do you think being in Toronto in the 70s, that's where the big pre-Guitar Foundation of America, that's where the big competition was, right?
Toronto Fest.
So being there.
72, I think it began. Uh-huh.
And that's when you graduated. So the thing being, I mean, you were right in the middle of, it's sort of like what an Austin is now in the United States. It's sort of what, it's yes, the center of the hub. Guitar universe.
It was a big hub. And we brought in many guitarists. And it was in great part thanks to Eli Kastner, he'd invite all the different guitarists to stay in his home. So that's how I met Leo Brower, whose music I never played, sadly. He always wanted me to play his music.
Why didn't you play his music? Were you, obviously you work with all sorts of different artists. What was it about? Were you just kind of, you had other projects probably when he was a
project? I commissioned all kinds of composers to write for me. I wasn't that much into his style, although I know he's written some amazing things. I don't know. I just was always busy with other concertos I had to learn or commissioning works, sometimes from non-guitarists, which were murder to play, and I didn't particularly like them. Jack Duarte, remember that character?
Yes.
John Duarte, he wrote Danzari because he accused me of playing picture postcards. I think it was because I did an album called The Best of Leona Boyd years ago, the one where I sat on the horse. But people love the melodic things, and I've always loved melody. And I'm glad to hear, I listened to some of your podcasts, that it's on the way back, because I used to make my audiences suffer with all this contemporary music that I did for 4 years at the University of Toronto. Very weird things. I loved Casanova Tedesco, and just wish I had recorded more of my early things that I used to play at the different guitar societies here, but I didn't record any of that. The Chaconne, I had a copy of myself playing that.
Wow, it's true, because you think about it, I mean, you were kind of swept up by CBS right out of the gate. Yeah, they probably told you what to play, right?
CBS, yes, they were. They used to tell me more than my original label, Boot Records. I did the first three albums. And interestingly enough, one of them was one called Miniatures for Guitar that I still love to listen to. And I've just brought out a book called The Cat Who Played Guitar. And at the end, the cat, Muffin, my cat, plays in the audio version, plays these little pieces. Of course, it's all from miniatures, which I recorded in 2 days because I had a boyfriend flying in from New York. Silly, I had 4 days booked, but I'm delighted with it. And then I did some music videos to that. You can even see my cat on Adelita and the Studio by Tárrega. Tárrega was one of my favorite early composers, and I played that Gran Jota all over the place. It was such fun. I used to love the different variations, and I added a little bit. I think one of my biggest compliments ever was when Pepe Romero called me and he said, I'm about to call the Gran Jota, to record the Gran Jota de Concerto. But I studied yours first because you got the best one so far. And I was very honored because Pepe's an amazing guitarist. The whole family.
And so you know, we're talking a lot about Paris, and that's where you spent sort of your formative guitar years prior to being in Toronto. So you were with Lagoya at that point?
He taught summer classes in Nice, which were wonderful. And I was just always in love with the guitar and thought nothing of practicing 6 or 7 hours a day. But I also loved to travel, so I'd go busking around the cafes in Nice to get enough money to go to Venice. And that was a dream come true. A girlfriend and I went. So my whole career has been about combining interesting travel with being able to play. But I was kind of a workaholic. I never stopped practicing in airports and ladies' rooms and baby diaper changing rooms, anywhere I could get a quiet place. You know, while I was waiting for my plane to arrive, somebody would say, do you want to play in Kathmandu? Sure, I'll be there. When do you want me to come? So I used it as my guitar was, I've said this before, kind of a passport to the world. Right. And I played for all kinds of society events and charities, raised a lot of money over the course of my career, which is very gratifying.
Yeah.
Malaysia was for abused women, I remember, and India, I traveled all over India, took my mother on one of the tours. She loved it. And I played in very remote areas, both in the US and Canada, because I was with Columbia Artist Management. And what they would do is, in between the major cities, they'd stick all these little places, you know, Silver City, New Mexico, a lot of small places you wouldn't have heard of necessarily, but the whole town would come out, and I'd have to take little planes, scary little planes, or taxi through the mountains. I was mostly on my own. I didn't have a tour manager until much later, and then twice I had my own band. So a lot of touring, a lot of traveling. Gosh, I know Canada inside out, and bad weather. It was always in the winter. Yeah.
I'll
getting
bet.
Stranded on icebergs, icebreaker to get off Prince Edward Island, for instance. I remember that. And I played for the native people up in the Mississauga River. What am I talking about? Sorry. The Missinaibie River. And they were Cree, Aboriginal people, and they had a lovely choir. They sang in Cree. And years later, I recorded something in Cree that's on my PBS Christmas special and on an album by the same name, A Winter Fantasy. It's a beautiful language. You know, there's so many variations of native languages here.
Is it okay if I chime in here for a second?
Yeah, Peter Bond, my producer.
His mystery voice is Peter Bond.
That's
so my name is Peter Bond. I'm producer and, you know, as musical director. And I've worked with her for 20 years and continuously for the last 13 years. The first time I worked with her was on Camino Latino way back in 2001, which I mixed. That was produced by Richard Fortin. And then I became her producer from 2008 onwards. But I was just going to say, like, in terms of the trajectory of her career, she, you know, gets a classical guitar when she's 13. She's, you know, immediately enthralled with it. And then those times in Paris, I mean, she studied so hard, and then she knew what the timing was to put out that first record. Because what's really interesting is she actually had an opportunity to make that first record 2 or 3 years before. I think it's 2 years before. And she said no. And I think that's amazing, because on paper, it'd be like, why would you turn that down? But the reason she turned it down was she knew she wasn't ready.
I needed and to get the final polishing.
Yeah, she somehow had the instinct that she wasn't ready. So then she goes to Paris and she studies She said she's a poor student. She's studying in her little room in Paris. And then she says in 1974, that's when I'm ready to put out this first record. And that record goes on to be the biggest selling classical record in Canadian history at that point.
Peter, it was actually the Christmas album that went platinum. And right. The record label was against me doing a Christmas album. They made me pay for half the budget because there hadn't been a Christmas classical guitar album and they thought it would be a complete flop. Anyway, right. It went as double platinum.
Yeah, now. So that's a few years later. That's in 81. I'm just saying that first record did very well.
Yeah,
and, so she comes out basically from obscurity to fame pretty quickly. And her work ethic was just incredible. So there's an 8-year stretch between 1974 and 1982 where she does not stop. She's either recording or touring
all over the world.
If you actually look at her diary, it's quite extraordinary what she
Peter
did.
Peter is my archivist, so we've gone over some of the crazy adventures.
Yeah, she didn't take a break until 1982. She literally went straight, and it was all TV specials. And anyway, I think it's just her. Her perseverance, her work ethic was absolutely extraordinary. And just
Well, I was in love with the guitar. So it was, yes, I was always replying to fans on, way before email, of course, on writing letters to composers. I wrote to Rodrigo. He almost composed a concerto for me, but then he ran out of time, sadly. But the people that I met along the way, it was fascinating when I met the royal family, and Prince Philip was a friend of mine until he had passed away. So I got to play for the Queen and meet the corgis and play for many dignitaries and heads like the summit conference. I sat with Reagan. It's a long time ago now, Margaret Thatcher. I knew so many politicians, and then I dated the Prime Minister of Canada for 8 years. So I guess that helped get me a few gigs in Ottawa. But it wasn't just that. It was.
When did you play Carnegie Hall? That was.
That was at the beginning. Yeah.
It was the beginning. Yeah. So there were like these key moments where the career would be forged, and that's another one, right? Whenever she was put in the hot seat, or these crazy things like playing in front of dignitaries or whatever, where she's, or playing with Gordon Lightfoot, which is another extraordinary thing that on paper shouldn't work, right? You have this basic folk rock crowd. Right. And you're going to put a solo classical guitarist up as the warm-up act. First of all, that was Gordon Lightfoot thinking outside of the box. But Leona was not like anyone else. She had completely had that audience in the palm of her hand. They were quiet. They would be.
And I played strictly classical. I played Debussy. Yeah,
which is pretty amazing. And that's part of how she got the sort of wider fame far outside the sort of small classical world.
But over 100 concerts with Lightfoot in these stadiums, 15, 20,000 people a night, big super troopers on me and little me in the center of the amphitheater.
Super troopers being spotlights.
Yeah, I was just listening to the ABBA song, do my exercise to super trooper. but it was scary at the beginning. We started in Minneapolis and then he saw, like, audiences today would not sit through half an hour of classical guitar. No way. We had a couple of disasters. You know, the disasters are the fun things to write about in my books. I always wanted to be a writer. So I tell the Denver Coliseum disaster story where the sound didn't work. And, I slunk off thinking I'd ruined my career. But I got to have a thick skin, I guess, even though I sometimes get very upset if reviewers were not fair. Sometimes I get rave reviews for a concert that I didn't think I'd done well at all, and then get panned with something where I put my whole heart and soul into it. I don't know whether you know my different pieces I've composed, but I think one of the ones I'm the most proud of is My Land of Hiawatha. It's a three-part suite of pieces I dedicated to my teacher here, Ellie Kastner. And it wasn't contemporary, so I don't think he really appreciated it, but it's got lots of interesting techniques. And it's very original, and it's off an album called Classically Yours, where I wrote all the music. You can get them all on iTunes, on...
Oh, yeah, though, they're all there.
Spotify, yes, everything's
there. Which is great. Now. That's really good, because that's not usually the case with everybody from your era. A lot of those sort of record companies, you know, like if you look up, I talk about it a lot, but Elliot Fiske was on Telarc and now there's no Elliot Fiske.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah, there's some things with stuff of that era where the rights get some kind of weird purgatory and they're not just
No, but I was very really smart. I paid quite a lot, but I bought all my masters back from Sony. CBS became Sony. I was with CBS when they switched. The new man said, I hate classical guitar. We're going to send you off to Mexico to do a cheap mariachi record. And idiot me, huge career mistake. I said, fine, I'll get out of a 5-record contract that I had just signed. Oh, that would have been so huge in Mexico. And I speak Spanish. I used to live in Mexico. What was I thinking? Anyway, then I was with A&M Records and Polygram for a while. I have my own label now, of course, but I'm distributed by Universal. But nothing like being with the original CBS Masterworks. They were very appreciative of me. They'd fly me to...
When classical was a mainstream thing, really.
Yeah. Well, that's what I wanted to ask. Yeah. Was
in those days,
we've been talking a lot about people liking or disliking classical guitar. At least it's kind of come in waves. And one of the things you talked about was that you opened for Gordon Lightfoot, and sometimes people would have a hard time listening to a half an hour of classical guitar. How would you deal with those situations? What was sort of your approach? Because it is very unique.
Well, they listened. They listened in silence, and then I got wild ovations. And Gordon would bring me back afterwards. I'm saying now, these days, the kids would not listen.
I disagree with that. That's what my argument was that you were. That I think anyone else being put out on the stage in that context, it would have been a total fail. But there was something about Leona and her charisma and her ability to set a spin. That, and Gordon Lightfoot said so himself in the
I know, but
documentary
times
from 1999.
Changed.
Yeah,
kids
well,
don't have the attention span, but I must
point
have had
is
some
it,
charisma.
It passed. It did well because it was you. Yes.
Thank you, Peter. Sweet of you to say that. Thank you. But even more than the Lightfoot audiences, I did the Tonight Show 3 times. I was invited back the 4th time, but I had a terrible manager who didn't allow me to do it. And those audiences were massive. The Today Show, too, and I always remember like the night. The day after, if I played the night before on one of those shows, everybody recognized me because there were very few channels. Everybody watched Johnny Carson.
That's true.
So they knew me. And so that helped, promote the guitar. And Johnny Carson actually had a son who I didn't really know Corey very well, but he played classical guitar. And Johnny really loved it. So it's a long time ago. But I did many, many TV shows and had my own specials. I played in Liberace presented me, not in his show, at the university in Las Vegas, a classical show that I did the whole thing, but he came and introduced me on stage. So I thought that was very kind of him. And then I shared his manager for a while, but I didn't want to be in his shows because it just didn't feel too show busy for me. I was still a bit of a purist.
It's a little bit not kind of what we do, is it?
Yeah. I had to say no at a certain point. It's a bit embarrassing.
But people you did say yes to were Chet Atkins, Eric Clapton.
Oh, yes. You know. Chet was amazing. He was a guitar addict like me.
You must have had a relationship with him because he was a classical, he at least...
They were good friends.
Yeah, I played the Nashville Guitar Society, and I was doing Nashville Guitar Society and Knoxville Guitar Society. Mm. And he invited me the next day to his RCA offices and said, can you teach me how to do that 2-string trill? Then he called it the Leona trill because his wife is called Leona, L-E-O-N-A. And of course, my name's always had an I. And then he incorporated it, and he taught it to Lenny Bro. And he introduced me to Lenny Bro. Do you know him, the great jazz guitarist, who sadly is no longer with us? I knew them all, Paco de Lucia. I mean, so many are no longer around. It was, Chet was always wanting to learn. And Shel Silverstein, gosh, is he dead too? I don't know. Oh, dear. He had this idea of putting a quartet together. We'd all wear tuxedos and cowboy boots. Tuxedo like my cat wore on my guitar for Christmas book. I had a little tuxedo made. And then after we were the 4 of us, it was John Knowles, John Pell. They were both fabulous studio musicians, and Chet and I, we just recorded in his home studio. And then it was a black and white cover, actually. So
this is the cover. And speaking of things that rights are lost in oblivion, this record is not on Spotify.
Yeah,
and most people don't know it exists, but there's Leona looking cute as a button. There's Chet Atkins, John Pell, and John Knowles. And they made this record in 1980, or 79, rather. And it'd be great to see this get released.
We don't know how.
It's very charming. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, what was Shel Silverstein's relationship with that quartet?
He had the idea. He met me and then he said, Chet, you got to do an album with this lady. Yeah, he just had, he had the sound. And I was writing some country music at that point. I almost got all kinds of deals, but they usually fell through. So that's why I ended up writing my own music. So he took me into a little studio and I wasn't singing. I used a studio singer. I have them somewhere in my archives on cassette, but I always had an interest in songwriting. And then when the second chapter or second half of my life began, post-focal dystonia, that I understand you went through too, but sorry to hear that. Anyway, it does push you to reinvent yourself. And
when was that?
Was an interesting, that's how I came to work more with Peter. Because I started with Camino Latino, which was, you know, a simplified technique. It wasn't doing the very complicated classical pieces I used to do, and invited all kinds of Latin jazz artists like Stransom Farrar and Aldo Meola.
So smart.
Steve Morse, who else? Gosh, Luis Villegas.
Steve Morse. Yeah.
Yes, well, it's
so
amazing.
It's so interesting because that was, I remember when I got it, which was over a decade now. I read an interview with you because you look up the, you know, I was just kind of grasping at straws for anybody else who had it, and you said something that was so effective, and you were like, "There's so much music I can still play," and yeah. I just remember you saying that. I remember reading the article and thinking, "Yeah, you know, I can't do everything. I can't play every movement of every Bach suite at tempo, but I can still do a lot of guitar." And that's what I did. And a lot of it had to do with that comment. So it was just very helpful. And I mean, you can see what, you know, when people sort of ask me whether or not it's a really bad thing, I think, well, I don't know if it's a bad thing or a good thing, but I know that it did force me to compose.
Good.
Release my own compositions and to also work with other musicians, which is what you were just talking about.
Yes.
I worked with a quartet for a while. But you, Stransom Farrar were so, when I was a kid in high school.
Speed demons. Yeah, and they're very nice. I got to know the whole setup, and then they were absolute workaholics too, which I admired.
Yeah.
So many of them, and they all worked with picks. So I think
that's
three times as fast as I could. But no, what broke my
heart. Have you heard Amos Mundo's the piece with them on it that's on Camino Latino?
No.
It's actually Amos one Mundo's, of our favorites
wrote,
on that album.
I wrote for them, yeah.
Wow. That's it. When you get a chance, listen to that. It's still one of our favorites. And they're just speed demons and that, but they sound amazing. And
just for the listeners to know, because I don't know if they're prepared for this.
Sorry.
It's okay. But Peter is, Peter, let's just, with you, you and Leona got together during the sort of post-Dystonia era. And was that just sort of a way where you?
No,
what happened? I mean,
when did you guys get together?
That was in 2001, and that was the beginnings of focal dystonia for Leona, but she didn't really know what was happening. She just thought, why is my hand not
moving? I took 10 years off.
So it was really after Camino. 2003 is when she formally retired from playing classical live. And really, she'd been there and done that as well. There was
heart. I couldn't do tremolo.
I mean, it does break your heart.
So much. I went to the NIH and had Botox injections in my arm and all kinds of painful things going on. And I write the whole story in my book, in my second book, No Remedy for Love. The first book I was just zooming all over the world, having adventures in every country.
Having fun.
That's called In My Own Key, My Life in Love and Music. And my mother patiently typed it. I didn't even type in those days. But yes, the focal dystonia sent me on a different course. And then when I was living in Miami, it ended up that I got divorced because my husband wanted me to quit the guitar. And I was adamant that I wanted to play the guitar, even though I couldn't play at the same level. Mm-hmm. Peter and I did an amazing album called Seven Journeys, my spiritual New Agey album, which is all beautiful melodies and soundscapes, and it was magical. In a way, it's very different to anything I'd done, right?
Right, but I would say the thing with Leona and what was so important to preserve was that I'd say, I mean, she has a tone that nobody else has. That's one of the things. Mm-hmm. She has there's a way you can have the same guitar. I can play that guitar. I can have someone else play that guitar. And then you put it in her hands and it sounds like her, which the great players, as you know, do. And nobody can sound like that. Even if she plays one note, there's a certain kind of almost vocal tone and a kind of mid-range presence to it. It's like a magic thing. And she still has that. And also her beautiful melodies that she writes. So there was so much there, so much beauty and musicality and expression that was still there that was, you know,
I didn't want to give it away
because you can't play Bach. It's like, no, there's so much more she can do. And also she always had an interest in doing those things. And in a way, the focal dystonia allowed her to go to down different path, which was writing, you know, maybe getting songs. To writing some songs and exploring other things. So she actually didn't feel limited. I know it sounds strange, but after her, like at first it was devastating, right? And then something turned around where it became, you know, a new path.
Well, I enjoyed doing the thing that I never in a million years thought I could do, which was singing. And then I loved songwriting. I'd always been good at writing poetry. I was an A student in English literature, almost took that and not music when I had the choice. But thank you, Peter. No, it opened up a whole second part to my career. And I toured with three different duet partners, accompanists over the years. My Croatian guy, Srđan Čavarđe, and then Michael Savona, and Andrew Dolson, and each one of them was wonderful in their own way and helped me. You know, I loved singing. I never forgot lyrics. And the audiences thought I'd been singing all along. They'd congratulate me on we saw your concert 10 years ago and loved your singing. I said, well, I was playing purely classical guitar, but then I stopped correcting them if they wanted to think I was always singing fine. I did do one song years ago with Roger Whittaker. This sort of became a bit of a hit here on my Christmas Dreams album. What's it called again?
Christmas Dreams, the title.
It's just called Christmas Dreams, right? And it's on the PBS special. We all sing it together with the choir. I played a lot of children's choirs, which was always delightful. It just gave me so many different experiences. Otherwise, I'd just be playing, you know, purely classical guitar. And I found this was fun to have a rock band, to have tour buses. I mean, it's agony and ecstasy. A lot of agonies along the way, too, with bad managers or bad record company decisions. That's why I wrote the book so that fans of mine could have a behind-the-scenes glimpse of what goes on. It's not just, you know, prettily gliding onto the stage. And
what were some of the more challenging things that went on? Obviously, you said personally there was a divorce that you went through as a result.
Yeah, that was very hard.
The pressure, I know personally, the pressure of having something like focal dystonia can have on the people around you. It's and your relationships.
My husband would say there were three people in the marriage: you, me, and the guitar. And he said, your guitar has to go. And I said, no, my darling, I can't let the guitar go. But in the end, after 5 years, he did find a wife who was much more suitable in a way. But it was a lovely chapter in my life, living in Beverly Hills, traveling around the world. Sometimes I would play a major concert hall like the Cairo Opera House. And then we'd go off on one of his WPO conventions and we went everywhere in the world. I mean, you name it, down the Nile, all over Europe. I was privileged to have so many exciting trips. And he came with me sometimes on tour. Sometimes he would be cursing, what are we doing in Saskatoon with the freezing weather when we could be back in Beverly Hills. I just love the variety that my career has had. It certainly hasn't been boring for a minute. The latest album is a Latin album, and I got the idea because I've traveled in Colombia, and I love Colombian music. I'm a fan of some of the singers and some of the instrumentalists. I'd done some Brazilian music before. I was good friends with Lorando Almeida. Felt guilty because he wrote a concerto and I never played it, but he did write a little a samba choro for Leone. He wrote it on the plane, he told me, and I recorded that not on an album but on one of the videos. Got all kinds of music videos, but this latest album is called L-O-V-E, L plus, you know, period O. And they've all got, almost all of them, all but one, right, have music videos. And Peter was very helpful with that, too. He helped with some of the editing because Peter went to film school. So finally, an album of mine you can dance to. I don't know if you've heard it.
Yeah, I've heard that album. And I do. Have you? Yeah, it's got it's got a lot of, you know, you've got electronic beats in there and everything.
Well,
and
thanks, Peter.
You're also really sort of, you know, you're still using the classical guitar and you're still using the repertoire and the tradition.
And every technique
I
can.
Yeah, and you hear it in a lot of those intros too. Yeah.
Yeah, they came to me so naturally.
We talk, I mean, yeah, that album is really interesting. And it's two albums that come up.
And by the way, it's actually a lot more played than you think, because, I mean, as the producer and the person who played the other parts that aren't Leona, it's most of the percussion is all played live, and all the and bass, everything. So it's actually lots of stacks, and lots have done a lot of the percussion with found objects. There's all kinds of interesting household objects that are making all the layers of percussion that are in there. People think it's probably all loops or something, but it isn't. It's all played. And there's lots of other guitar-y things going on. It's still very guitar-based, actually. Anyway.
We talked a lot, you know, about your traveling and what traveling means to you, and how it seems to have meant to you, especially during the 70s, just as much as the guitar. It was sort of used in tandem, it seems like.
Yes.
And that's sort of crystallized on the album from 1984, Live in Japan. That's the one that I got. That was the first album that I picked up.
Live in Tokyo.
Oh, Live in Tokyo.
Tokyo, yeah. And it's
classic album.
Your career up to that point was crystallized in that album, it seems like, especially after talking to you today. It seems technically you have complete command of the instrument, and you seem really at home with your repertoire. And like you said, it seems like you had gone up to 1972, then you took a little break, or at least a moment to stop. But as far as traveling was concerned, do you kind of feel like that album was sort of the culmination?
No, 72. I just graduated university.
Wait, so what?
He meant 82. So I was saying it's like first record comes out in 74. I'm saying she went straight from 74 to 82.
That's right. That was in 84. Yeah. That album came out in 84.
That's right. So it's one after her sabbatical, as it were. Yes.
So
and I agree. That's one of my sabbatical. That's an amazing record.
What but my live in Tokyo, that was done. In the middle of a big tour all over Japan. I'm playing with orchestras too. And I did 10 concerts in a row in Tokyo at the Honda Theater, and had, again, lots of interesting experiences. They made a TV special. I wish I had it. The NHK. It's buried in some archive, I guess. And they're guitar fanatics. I'd have, you know, people lining the streets. There were posters everywhere. I was a big star in Japan, and unfortunately, my manager never picked it up. Again, 10 concerts in a row, and they all sold out. Yeah.
And how many did you record for that album? I think it's based on 2 nights.
They let me record 3, and it was basically the live album. They used take 2, but there was a cough or an odd squeak. We did minimal editing. We did it in the middle of the night. I hardly slept on that tour. Japanese wanted to interview me and photograph me and take me all over the country and take me up Mount Fuji. You know, I didn't get much of a break. But it was all very exciting. We were on trains, and I played everywhere, even Fukuoka, Osaka, with the most beautiful concert hall in Osaka. I played with a chamber orchestra. I played in the Bunka Kaiken, the huge concert hall. And I had a big showdown with the conductor who refused to let me use a microphone, and I refused to play without. So all these things are all described in my first book. With orchestra.
In my own key, yeah.
You really do need some kind of amplification against a whole symphony orchestra.
I think that's fair. And I think that that's something that, we're kind of, I hope it's something that guitarists are starting to realize, because we can hurt ourselves, right? Playing 10 shows in a row.
Yes, we need microphones. But I remember Michael Lorimer showed me originally years ago how to put a little tiny Shure mic on a coat hanger. Nobody could even see it. A bent coat hanger. I'd take it all over with me. It was a funny device. Of course, now I have a much better setup.
Work? What was it?
He showed me. Do you know Michael Lorimer?
He lives in New York. Yeah.
Yes. He just showed me how to make one. And I had a tour manager, and we'd set that up, and people would say, but you didn't have a mic. And I would say, yes, I did. It was just tiny. Didn't you see it? The front rows saw it. But then, when I was singing, of course, I needed a whole different setup, and we had in-ear things so much gear when I started singing. And I thought, Segovia was so smart, just the guitar. But, it was hard to hear him. And I'd sit in the back of Massey Hall when he came to Toronto, and we'd just hear this thin little sound. If only he'd fused the mic, it would have been.
Yeah, because he wouldn't amplify.
No, he was old school, the old maestro wanted. But John Williams sort of got in trouble, I think, for starting to amplify his guitar. But Segovia was a purist, and I was very lucky to have met him and played for him. I met so many interesting people. Pablo Neruda, I met. Then I played in Chile and actually went to his house. He died by then. But I made a list the other day of all the interesting, almost household names.
Yeah.
So Edmund Hillary, people that nothing to do with the guitar that I'd meet on talk show or on planes. I was adventurous.
Definitely. And I mean, looking at you, not many people could say that they have dated a prime minister.
Yeah, well, he was very upset when I left him.
He was.
His son, who I used to play with in the woods, Justin, is now our Canadian prime minister.
That's right.
I remember him being a little toddler.
Oh, my gosh.
And they got them all guitars.
Oh, you did? All the kids?
Pierre wanted them to play guitars, but Justin wanted to play country guitar, steel string. He didn't want a classical guitar. And sadly, the little one died and was drowned in a lake. But that's another lifetime.
And, that is.
And I'm not so young anymore. Try my best to look young.
You're and living
Peter
a very...
helps me with good lighting.
You're definitely living a really younger lifestyle, especially with you just had an album come out this year. You had an album come out a couple of years ago. You keep on releasing. You're not.
Yeah. And the videos keep coming out.
Down.
We have a new
you're speeding
one.
Up.
We've had all these videos
out. True.
There's one left.
Well, that's absolutely true. She's been, consistently making music, because she wants to, because that's life to her.
I think it's time to quit now.
I don't think
time
so.
To quit. Well, maybe I'll write some more books. I hope the children's book does well, because that's something that channels your inner child. It's a great bedtime story. And I also did an audiobook so people can have me read to them at night and hear all these beautiful little gems of pieces I recorded years ago on the Miniatures album. And that was a labor of love. I wanted my husband, who bought me the cat Muffin, to know that I'd immortalized him, because he was important. He was my only child.
Yeah.
I haven't had children, I guess, because I was so busy producing albums, my songs and my children.
Yeah,
I didn't have time for family.
I understand that. That's
and I married a man with four sons, so he didn't want any more.
He was all set up.
Do you have kids, Brett?
I don't have kids. I got married a couple of weeks ago, and
congratulations,
first time. So I'm just trying to
congratulations.
I'm going to do the kid thing now. We'll have to see.
I hope she loves classical guitar.
I think she does. I think she does. She has to listen to this, and she has to listen to the guitar. And we're just making that. We're doing the best we can. It's still like a work at home situation. So I'm practicing, and she's doing advertisements for Capital
because of
One.
COVID. You mean?
COVID just made it where it's part of like it's like a negotiation chip. When you get a new job, you could be like, I want to
work at home some days.
Yeah.
yes.
So that's what's going on over here. But you know, I mean, it's as far as you have been speaking a lot and just looking at your career, looking not just at your career, your personal life, everything about you, you really have just, you've been everywhere. And I can understand how that spirit sort of is starting to play itself and not starting to, but has been playing itself into your music, particularly over the last 20 years.
Yes, I get ideas when I'm on the road.
I just don't get how people don't get bored. You know, I mean, I just playing, you know, there's nothing wrong with Bach and Scarlatti and Tauriga and everything.
I played a lot of Bach and Scarlatti.
But how long are you going to do that for? Are you going to do that for 70 years? I mean,
no.
You go crazy.
That's sort of what I was saying earlier when I was talking about the transition in her career after 2003. She couldn't, I mean, she wasn't going to top herself. So why not do something different? Even putting Focal Dystonia aside, why not do something different? Because she done that and conquered, right? Leona's a one-off. There is nobody who has a career like her, and there's nobody who blazed the trail that she did.
Well, we love what you do, Leona, and it's really thank you for being so inspirational to all of us over the years.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming on. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
So much insight into her career. And, you know, we're really lucky that you came on as well. So I can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Brett. Have a lovely day.
Okay, that does it for my time with Leona Boyd. Please consider visiting brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. You can give me a little wedding present or something to that effect. I believe it's 100, I think it's 200% write-offable. I'm not sure about that. I don't know anything about it. I haven't signed up for any of the, you know, I need a lot of money things. You know, looking for a government handout. Anyway, it's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Also, make sure you visit Savage Classical. That's S-A-V-A-G-E classical.com. SavageClassical.com. For all of your guitar needs. And I will see you in 2023. Happy holidays, everybody.